had worked at Tiffany's.
Yes, this was Clarence Karstad. And let's say the great watercolor renderer. He did these marvelous little watercolor sketches.
Uh-huh.
And but he was the only one in this office when I started there, and so it was just him and me.
Mm-hmm.
And
which was the which office? The
in John Jarda's.
Oh, okay, yeah.
General
Design Office.
Yes. As I say, John and Ralph Roberts shared a common large, a very plush office in the center of the of this group.
Uh-huh.
And on the one side was Jarda's design,
mm-hmm.
which was Clarence Karstad and me,
your
this apprentice designer.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And on the other side was the interior and custom studio under Ralph Roberts, and that's where Phil Wright worked, and another fellow that worked there at that time was Bob Cotto.
Oh, yeah.
You probably know Bob Cotto.
Yes, right. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
He worked for Phil Wright and Ralph Roberts.
He worked with Phil Wright
for
Ralph Roberts, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Roberts was chief of that section, and Jarda was chief of our
uh-huh.
operation.
Mm-hmm.
And our our duties, as I remember at that time, were making suggestions for Ford Motor Company for front-end designs.
Really?
Front ends and hubcaps and details like that.
Mm-hmm.
And
you remember some of the Fords that you worked on?
Yes, let me see. The I think it was the 36. 36.
Oh, yes. All right.
Yeah. The 35s had been done, and we were working on the 36s. And we had a above the design studios was a large showroom,
mm-hmm.
and that's where the full size prototypes were shown. Shown to Ford management.
This was on Mack Avenue.
Mack Avenue.
Whereabouts on
Mack? It was right next to the Continental Motors. But I don't know the street.
Oh, yes, okay.
Continental Motors is right next door.
Mm-hmm.
And we drove in off of Mack Avenue, and Continental Motors was here, and Briggs was here, and there was a parking lot here, and we were on the top floor, next
mm-hmm.
to the top floor, the
mm-hmm.
showroom was on top.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right in the front of the building. And we had in our studio we had one clay modeler, and I'm trying to think of his name. It was a German fella. And I lived across town. I lived over near Linwood Avenue. And his name was John. John Beck or something like that. I'm not sure that that last name. His first name was John, and he lived over near me. And he had a car, and I would take the streetcar over in the morning from where I lived to Briggs, and then John would drop me off at night on the way home across town. But he was our clay modeler, and did full size clay models, and we had a big paint oven that you could drive a full-size car in to,
mm-hmm.
and that's where we heated the clay. And me being a junior designer, it was one of my duties is to get this clay out of the packages that they were shipped in, the crates they were shipped in.
It was the famous
regular modeling clay. It was
yes.
brown modeling clay.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Smell like hell. It smelled like sulfur. You can get the smell
yeah.
of it.
Right here, yeah.
But we'd unload it, put it on a big dolly, and then wheel it into this paint oven,
mm-hmm.
turn the lights on, and when it got soft enough, we'd go in there and have to drag this cart out. And in the summertime, being on the top floor, and no air conditioning, and in this paint oven, it was kind of warm. And Walt Wingren was the other junior designer on the other side, and so he and I would go in and get these carts of clay and wheel them out, and then use spatulas because the clay was so hot, and we'd clay up these big wooden full-size mock-ups.
This was the work that the apprentices did?
Yes, right. We'd throw the clay on these full-size bucks. And then...
Working for Beck at that time?
Well, yeah. His name was John Bach, I think.
Oh, Bach, I'm sorry.
I believe it was Bach. No, I said Beck first. I think it was John Bach.
B-O-C-H or B-A-C-H?
B-O-C-H.
Was he a pretty tough taskmaster?
No, he was a real nice guy. And older fella, and he always smoked a pipe. His pipe was continually in his mouth. Working or driving or probably even sleeping, but very, very nice guy. So I did a little, was able to do a little clay modeling then too, helping him. So I learned a bit about how to set a clay buck up for modeling.
Yes.
And got familiar with modeling tools and so on. And then I was doing sketch work with Clarence Karstadt on front end ideas for mm-hmm. Ford.
You worked on that famous 1936 front end?
Well, I don't know where that good 36 front end came from.
Oh.
But I don't think it came out of Briggs.
I see.
I'm not sure. I don't remember working on it. And
Bob Gregory was then pretty much beginning to head up a styling studio at Ford. You know?
Might have come from Gregory. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just don't know where that was. It was a good looking front end. The whole car, the 36 car, was a good looking automobile.
Very nice.
And I remember doing a design on a full size wood buck that we had there, that was just in the rough, and John Jard asked me to sketch out a shape of a grill on that, and I remember doing that, and it looked something like the Auto Union, the one I sketched, as I remember, it was an oval top, and then it came out into the catwalk a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And Jarda liked that idea, but it never got any place. I don't know what happened to it. We never.
The Auto Union, was that a German?
Yes, that was a German race car.
Right.
Racing.
And
I believe it evolved into the Audi.
That's what I was thinking.
Audi had used the four interlock circles.
Rings. Uh-huh.
Yeah, rings.
I think Audi comes from that Auto Union company.
Auto Union, right.
Yeah, right.
And anyway, I say the I don't remember much more about our operation there, other than I remember twice while I was there, Henry Ford and Ezra Ford came over to view some work that had been done there.
You just had a chance to glimpse them, I take it. You didn't have a chance to meet them.
That's right. No. No, I was hovering around the clay room there someplace, but I saw them come in, and John Jarda and Ralph Roberts were showing him this full-size model that had been done. But
this was 35.
Yes, this was in 35. Now.
Tell us a little bit about Ralph Roberts. He's quite a legendary figure.
Yeah, he was a very nice guy, and a very very sharp guy, very natty dresser. So was John Jarda. They were very very classy gentlemen, and I was very impressed with both of them. Mm-hmm. That was war. French cuffs, cufflinks, and good-looking suits, and
if they took their coats off, they wore vests.
John Jarda wore colored vests, as I remember. He had I remember him wearing a red plaid vest, and a yellow and black. Plaid vest, things like that.
Yeah. Did you call him Cutter?
Hmm?
Cutter, did you say?
Mm.
Brownie, or
colored? Colored, colored, yeah. And John Jarda had done the Strickenberg car, of course.
Yes.
And that's how...
The teardrop shape.
The teardrop, the rear engine. Mm-hmm.
That
and
was
that's
Strickenberg
how,
ST. The type was...
Yeah, I...
Strengerg.
Now,
he had done that, I think, in his native Holland.
I believe so.
And later in the United States, this was very much an influence on him, wasn't it, in terms of his design?
Yes, he...
Strengerg teared up.
I think that's how he happened to be at Briggs, on the strength of that design.
Yeah.
And in fact, there was interest in Ford Motor Company at that time, a rear engine car, and that's
right.
That's what he was working on.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere along the line, before I got there, he had made up a model, it was an all metal model of a rear engine car, looked very much like the Strickenberg.
Right.
And that was there in the design department.
Oh, that was still there?
It was still there. And
the one that had been in the World's Fair exhibit.
Yeah, yeah. And there was a fellow there that had...
We had photographs of it, and I've often wondered just what happened to it. So Briggs took it back. Charlie took it back to Briggs after the World's Fair.
Evidently, yeah.
Okay. What color was it? We only have black and white. Do you remember the color?
No.
Was it gold? It seems to be.
I just don't remember.
Okay.
There was a young chap there that really impressed me at the time. He was hired by Jarda. He had made a model of the Strickenberg in metal,
mm-hmm.
and the car that he had gotten the job with, and his sample of his work that he used as a sample, and he had worked, I think, at General Motors for a while too. But it was a 1932 Cadillac scale model, and it must have been, I forget what scale it was, but it must have been about 2 feet long,
mm-hmm.
I'd say,
mm-hmm.
and it was exact. Detail every rivet in the frame, and everything was in the motor was there complete, and all in metal. All the window, the glass in the windows, the remote control handles that were in the doors, and you could wind the windows up and down, and it was all to exact scale. It was a Cadillac 16, just scaled right down in minute detail.
What was his name?
And I've been trying to remember his name for a long time, and I can't. He was a red-headed fella, and he was sickly, and he looked sickly, and he died shortly after that. He was, I don't think he was over maybe 25, but he must have had tuberculosis or something.
Did he come up to see Jarda?
Well, he was there
when I
started.
And this was a hobby he had.
No, it wasn't a hobby. That was his thing. That's what he did. He made metal models.
For Briggs. Oh, okay.
And he did the Strickenberg model. And
Jarda, of course.
And he had done this model for General Motors, this
16.
The 16. But he had the model there, and I don't know how he happened to have it, if he did it for General Motors, but it was a fantastic piece of work. I've always remembered it. But I say, he wasn't there very long. I wasn't at Briggs very long, but he was there maybe a couple of months while I was there, and then he was gone, and then I heard that he died. Mm. But there was him, and then, as I mentioned, Bob Cotto was working for Ralph Roberts, and Bob worked in three dimensions. He did very little sketching.
He was a model.
Yes, yeah. And did great looking models. Yeah. His work, his designs, and each one of them had it. And the first time I'd ever seen it used was the eyebrow around the wheel openings of the.
Oh.
You know what I mean? The mm-hmm. the flange,
yeah.
Flanged eyebrow.
Mm-hmm.
Cars up to that time had a metal bead running around the openings, or they had or it was rolled under.
Mm-hmm.
The edge was rolled
uh-huh.
in, but Bob was doing designs with this little eyebrow, which I thought looked very good, and has been used ever since, and it's still being used.
Bob never really got credit for that.
No, I don't think so. Well, maybe he did, but somebody, but I don't ever recall anybody giving him credit for it. Oh, and Ralph Roberts had a beautiful automobile. It was a 1932 Chrysler Imperial Fadden, and it was his design. It was a LeBaron body on it, and it had chrome disc wheels, conical shaped chrome disc wheels, and two tires on the back. It had a small trunk on the back, and then these two rakish. Looking spare tires in the back, and this thing was like a block long.
Oh, God.
And he used to park it right down in front of the building in the executive parking area there.
Mm-hmm.
And I could look out and see him pulling in and pulling out of the parking lot in this gorgeous Chrysler. It was really too much.
Mm, must have been.
And
say it was red.
I don't think it was red. It was a darker color, and I can't remember what color it was. It might have been a maroon, might have been a dark maroon or something. But that was very impressive. But I don't remember what kind of a car Jarda drove. But they were the kingpins right there. So I stayed at Briggs. It wasn't quite a year. And and when I had interviewed old Larry, he told me to call him occasionally from time to time. Didn't have anything right then, but to call him occasionally and keep in touch with him.
Uh-huh.
So I did. I called him, and I had been at Briggs. I had a little working experience by this time, and. Told him what I'd been doing, and he said, "Well, I'd be interested in talking to you again." So I took the same samples over, and he hired me. And I think in the meantime, I had put watercolor on these. I had rendered them because
right.
I'd seen Karstadt the way he worked, and I could do a pretty fair little watercolor workout. So I colored them up and these line drawings and everything. And old Larry hired me for. $125 a month,
wow.
Which was a big jump up from the 60 I was getting at Briggs.
Right.
So I told John Jarda about my offer. He said, "Well, that's fair enough. You better take it. We can't give that to you here."
Right.
So I went to work for GM, and I worked for Frank Hershey in the Pontiac. For a while.
Now, did you? In 1935, did you say, "Frank, don't you remember me? You showing me that lovely car and
I didn't mention it to him then.
At that time,
no.
You did.
No, I kept a pretty low profile.
Did you?
Yeah, I was just hanging onto the job, and anybody that was a boss, I didn't talk to him very much. I was in awe of anybody like that.
Tell us a little bit about the art and color section at that time. What are your impressions of it as you first came in?
Well, I was impressed. I was impressed by it, of course, and I had met Harley Earl when I was hired.
Did you?
And
another impressive.
Yes, really, and the Art and Color wasn't very big at the time. In fact, it was just, as I recall, just like one huge room, and the studios were separated by blackboards.
Which actually has partitions.
Yeah. They weren't partitioned off, and they weren't separate rooms or studios, but they were had these full-size blackboards that the designs were drawn up on. In each studio, you usually have a scale model and a full-size model that was being continually worked on. And then you had the sketch tables that the designers worked on around the perimeter of the room, or the area. And then these blackboards kind of enclosing each one on four sides.
Was it on Second Avenue?
Yes, it was in the GM building, the original GM building.
Right.
And the pressure was pretty stiff there on the young designers. There was a big turnover, and I don't know whether it was company policy, whether it was Harley Earl's policy, or whose it was, but nobody seemed to last very long. There were a few key guys that had been there quite a while, like Frank Hershey and some of the key men, heads of the studios, but the guys who were doing this, the sketch designers, came and went with kind of a frightening regularity. Yeah. And anyway, I started to work for Frank. And
that was the, what studio was that?
That was Pontiac. And I was only there a short while, and then I was transferred into the Chevrolet studio. And I don't remember who was in charge of Chevrolet. But
Andrade, was that?
No, I don't believe it was him. I just can't remember.
What sort of work did they have you do?
I spent my full time at General Motors working on hubcaps and louvers. And,
very detailed.
Yeah, and just reams of this stuff. And that's what everybody else seemed to be doing, too. And you didn't get a chance, really, to work on a, at least at my level, on front ends or total concept of cars and say, hey, we need some louvers for this car, or we need some hubcaps or bumper guard suggestions.
Yeah.
And you just wouldn't make a dozen, you'd make dozens. And so...
He's slightly different.
Right. So, as I say, then... there was quite a bit of pressure, and your desks were fairly close together, and the fellow working next to you would get a call about 4:45 some afternoon, and he'd Harley or Larry would want to see him, and
who's that?
That's
Larry who?
Howard or Larry.
Oh yeah.
And so he would leave, and that's the last you ever see him. He'd come in the next day, his desk would be all clean, and we wouldn't be there anymore. And it was a little shaky for me. I didn't feel too comfortable there. So I'd worked there maybe 6 or 8 months, and I got a call from Bill Flagel. And Bill had worked with me at Briggs, and he was another apprentice designer. And I'd forgotten that he also worked for John Charta, and he worked mostly in the clay department. He didn't do any sketching up front, but he worked with John Bach in the clay department.
Spell his name.
Flajol. F L A J O L E. I believe that's right. J O L E. And I'm a terrible verbal speller. I've got to see it now. Anyway, Bill had made a move from Briggs and gone to Chrysler, and Chrysler at that time was just forming a design department. They had a small design department right along, but they wanted to enlarge it and split it up. They wanted an exterior department. They wanted an interior department, and they had hired Ray Dietrich Body to head up the exterior design department. And
what had he been doing since the breakup of Bear? Freelancing, perhaps.
Oh yeah, he was hired shortly after the breakup of Dietrich.
Yeah.
Dietrich went out of business about 1932. They'd separated from LeBaron. I think in the 1930 or 29 or something.
That's
like
right.
That.
Yeah. Okay. He had his own.
He had his own. He had his own plant in Troy, and did some beautiful things, beautiful cars, and was very successful up until about 1932, and then like a lot of people were wiped out by the depression and the lack of a market for custom bodies, and so he had. At that time, been offered a job at Chrysler by Walter P. Chrysler, and who he had known through the custom body business. He was quite friendly with Walter P. So Mr. Chrysler offered him this job, and he was doing that. Starting this design department, also teaching in the engineering. They had a little engineering school at Chrysler, and he was teaching body layout.
Chrysler Institute,
right. So that's it was the latter part of 1935, then that I Bill asked me if I'd be interested in making a change to Chrysler, and I said, yeah, I would. And so I went over and was interviewed by Ray Dietrich and took the same samples along, my original samples.
Yeah,
I sure did.
What was Dietrich like? Was he pleasant?
Very, very pleasant guy. A very down-to-earth, regular guy. I mean, he never appeared to be the big executive or any of this. He was just one of the boys. And was quite a practical joker.
Was it?
He liked to tell a joke, liked to hear jokes, and liked to have a lot of fun.
Oh, that's
a good fun guy. Maybe a little bit too much for his own good.
Uh-huh.
But because he had a responsible job, you know. But he'd come in from his office into our design section. As I said, it was split up into two sections, the exterior and interior. There was a hallway running down the middle of engineering, building on one side was exterior, and the other side was interior. And at the end of the building was the clay modeling department and the body layout. And at the other end of the building, engineering building, was the showroom where the design prototypes were shown.
Was this the main Chrysler plant? Where was
this? This was the Highland Park engineering building.
Okay.
On Oakland Avenue.
Right.
And this was the top floor. It was the sixth floor at that point. And Ray would come into the design room there and. I was telling a joke or something, and he would tend to business. I mean, he wasn't just a continual joke or anything, but as I say, he was a practical joker and liked to kid around, right? And one of the things he'd like to do was to give you the hot foot. You'd be sitting there at your desk, you'd walk in, we had big desks there, and stools that we sat on. And each fellow had his kind of his own little compartment. And he'd come around and look at your stuff, what you were working on, and yeah, that looks pretty good, Reese. And start asking you about it, making suggestions and this and that. And pretty soon you'd feel this, some heat on your foot. You know, look down, here's a match sticking out of there, out of your sole of your shoe. Your shoe would be starting to catch fire.
So Mr. Dietrich was something of a practical joker for you at this point.
Yeah, right. But I could go on about that. I mean, there were many things.
Well, what other forms did he practice jokes?
Well, we had... We were doing a lot of airbrush work at the time, rare airbrush renderings.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd have little rubber syringes that we'd use to put water in our paint dish or wash out our airbrushes with.
Uh-huh. Yes.
And it's like an ear syringe, you know, those rubber
right.
things. And have those sitting at on our tabouret by our desk. And he'd come in and be... You could almost depend on something happening if he'd come over and take a real interest in your work. And he'd start talking to you, and you'd be discussing the job, and pretty soon your pants would be wet. He would have the syringe, and while he'd be talking, he'd be holding this thing down so that water would be running underneath your pants, you know, your seat. So you'd jump up in the whole back of your pants and be you'd laugh like hell. You know. But but a really really nice guy. He did.
Easy to work for.
Oh yeah, yeah, and very knowledgeable. He knew the right lines. He could critique something intelligently and. As I say, he was a great lion when he'd go in the body layout and coach the fellows there in making full-size drawings. He had a beautiful sense of line and proportion. And I started there in 1935, and then in 1940, Walter Chrysler died. At the age of, I think, about 65. And then, not too long after that, why Ray left the company.
To move you back a bit, to ask a question that just occurred to me. With your movements between Briggs and Chrysler, did any of the airflow episode come within your purview? Did you hear any talk about it? Or?
No, the we didn't have anything to do with it, at least the exterior department at Briggs. I believe Briggs did a little of the interior design work on the airflow.
Yeah.
But the airflow was done primarily at Chrysler Engineering. It was an engineer's car. Carl Zeder and Skelton Breer. Designed that automobile from the, and very little styling went into that car, as is pretty evident. But the interior, I believe Briggs did do some work on that, and the interior was the best part of the car,
mm-hmm.
of the airflows. The interiors showed some very progressive work.
Mm-hmm. How about the redo, the ones that came along after the original airflow flopped, and they began both DeSoto and Chrysler had a redesigned airflow and carried it into the late 30s. Any of that work at Chrysler, did you work on that?
The original airflow, of course, was 34,
right.
And then in 35, The Chrysler Airflow had gained a little nose out because people objected to the waterfall in the front, the big blunt waterfall.
Right.
And so they wanted to see some hood out there. So the 35 had a little projection out there of a hood, and a little suggestion of the design of the 35, the regular Chrysler, the Airstream, I think they call the.
Yes, right.
35 body, which was a reverting back to the narrower type of body, which was all the fashion then because of the success of the 1934 LaSalle. This LaSalle set the pace, the styling pace for several years there with their good-looking 34 design.
Right.
They had that narrow radiator. Narrow grille, the streamlined headlights supported by struts off of the radiator shell, the pontoon fenders. And Chrysler went in this direction in 35, immediately after they saw the 34, of course. And that was all done before I arrived on the scene.
Mm-hmm.
I started, I think, in the fall of 1935 at Chrysler. And one of the things that was very tempting for me to leave GM to was the money. I got $200 a month at that. So in a little over a year, I jumped from $60 to $200, which was pretty good for a kid. And it was good money in those days. So I felt very very happy about being at Chrysler, and I like the I liked Reed Dietrich, I liked the company, and I liked all the people I worked with.
You had a pretty good little group here at the beginning.
Right.
Name some of them.
Yeah, there was there was Herb Weisinger was the key man of the exterior design. He had been there the longest of any of the designers. I think he started with Chrysler in 1928 or 29. And then there was Buzz Grissinger. Buzz had started there about 1932, I believe. And Max Wasserman. Max was a designer, formerly an architect, and he had done some architectural work for the Chrysler Corporation, and then architecture wasn't much doing in the Depression, and so he was able to get a job in Chrysler design department, and that was his background. Then Bill Fagel was there from
the one you'd asked to come over.
Right. had made the move from Briggs. And then there was another man there that was an engineer. He did more engineering type work in our department. That was Gus Sompe. Well, there's Ed Sheard, who had been formerly with worked for Amos Northrup at Hutmobile. And he was an Englishman, very nice guy, and
what was his specialty?
He worked on total concepts, like the rest of us. That was the difference between Chrysler and GM. GM was doing better design work at GM. They were a little more organized, or a little more specialized at the time. The designers there, as far as I knew, did very little total concept where you did the whole car, that type of thing. You're doing mostly detail work.
Right.
Somebody else usually,
right,
usually the key man of the department at GM, or Hardy Earl, or would set the general style of the car. And one of the older designers would usually do the front end, which was the face of the car. Harley always called the face of the car, which is the most important aspect of the car to him, and as the identification of the product.
Instant recognition.
Yeah, right. So most of the emphasis was put on the front end, and just a few of the designers really got an opportunity to really work on front ends as such. Guys like myself, which were new in the business, were put on the dog stuff. You know?
Yeah, right.
So that's why I appreciated it. At Chrysler, we were able to sit down and make drawings of whole cars,
right.
Front end, the side views, the rear, the whole thing, and work in perspective and work in color. Any way you wanted to work, you could work it. The only drawback with Chrysler was the fact that they had been burned badly by the airflow,
yeah.
Which they management thought was the future type design, and they had been burned by it, and it wasn't the fact that it was so much of it in the future, that it was just the way it was done. It was poorly executed. It had no style, and it didn't have any good looks. It was a wonderful car, a wonderfully engineered car. But they didn't seem to grasp that. They seemed to think that, gee, you just can't do radical things because the public don't want radical things.
They became very conservative,
mm-hmm. And they jumped back and said, well, let's follow GM. But whatever GM does, we'll do it like that, a little bit different. So that's what we had to fight. And we had some very progressive designers in our department. We turned out some real good-looking things around there, but it was never looked upon with favor by management. They didn't want to do anything unless they had seen it done before by somebody else, that somebody else had done it and had been successful. Okay, then follow that line and we're all right, just change it slightly.
Of course, the engineering department was dominant these days.
Engineering was dominant, and they looked upon styling as a necessary evil. They knew they had to have us, but they didn't like us. And
they could hire you 6 months out of the year.
Yeah, they. And if we wanted to do something that was advantageous to style, they'd say, "Oh, you can't do it. It just isn't feasible engineering wise." Like we had to stay with the butterfly type hood for a long time because. The alligator hood, they couldn't, the assembly line, there were overhead structure on the assembly line, that when the cars went down the line, the hoods, if they were alligators, they'd bang into them, so that we couldn't do alligator hoods. We had to do butterfly hoods. So it was things like this that shackled us to a great extent, but it was such a good company to work for. You hated to leave there, and there wasn't much other places to go at that time. There was General Motors, of course, but and Ford was just getting started in their design effort, and we didn't know. Nobody seemed to know too much about Ford at the time. They were kind of. You just didn't hear much about them. Usually you'd hear guys would come over from GM to Chrysler to look for a job, and you'd hear things, what's going on over there. You knew people over there. You had friends and so on, people that you knew. But at Ford, everything was pretty secretive. He didn't know much what was going on.
Low profile. I think Gregory says that he had a very small staff.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way Edsel liked it.
Yeah.
And he resisted overtures from both Charta and Alder Dorwin Teague to join the staff. He said, no, I've got small, lean staff, that's what I like.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So Gregory would, of course, collaborate with Charlotte and Chrysler on various decisions.
Yeah, they did some nice things, too. I mean, the 32 Ford was a nice car.
Yes.
The 33, which was a new body, the 34, good looking stuff. Then came the new body, then the 35s,
mm-hmm.
and the 36 was a knockout. The 37 was kind of fell off, but it had
an alligator hood.
Yeah, right. But then the Zephyr came out and knocked everybody's ears off.
Right, yeah.
And
the alligator hood started there.
Yes. Yeah, they didn't have those overhead obstructions that they had Ford. They're a little more modern, I think.
Dietrich's building quite a crew here. I'm impressed with the names of the people you worked with earlier and then later. You must have been quite a, at least in terms of their later successes.
Mm-hmm.
It must have been a great crew.
It was. We had it was a good crew. And
who's Don Mortrud, by the way?
Don Mortrud.
Mortrud.
Mortrud. Yeah, he's a fellow that
Mortrud.
Mortrud.
What was his specialty?
He was a fellow. He came from Seattle, Washington, and worked at General Motors when I worked there.
Oh, I see.
And he was one of the fellows that disappeared on the quarter to five.
That revolving door.
The revolving door. Again, the revolving door there. And then he went over to Chrysler, and I think he arrived at Chrysler just before I was hired there. So we arrived about the same time at Chrysler. And he's a very good designer. His real love was boats.
Boats.
Yeah.
That was Gregory's initial.
Was that right? Boats.
Yeah.
No, he and Don would have gotten along very well.
Mm-hmm.
And Don worked with us there until about 1939. We started in 35 or 39, and then he. Went to Nash, and he did the, must have been 38. Yeah, it was 37 he went to. He did the 39 Nash, and that had the very narrow grill, horizontal grill. And that was that was a typical Don Mortrud. He did that at Chrysler. One of the first things he did at Chrysler was that design, and just about everything he did after that looked like that, but he finally sold it to Nash.
He couldn't sell Dietrich, so he couldn't.
And, but that turned out real well. And then he also had, he went to work at Nash, and for George Walker. George Walker got the Nash account at that time.
Kidding, in the late 30s, huh?
Right. Mm-hmm. And as a consultant designer, and Mortrud worked for George Walker.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I could tell you a story about that, but I better not.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
And it sounds like backbiting or something.
Oh, no.
You can edit it out if you don't want to hear it.
Fine.
I'll just tell it to you anyway.
Oh, I love it. Yeah,
a little intrigue going on. As I say, that Mortrud worked with Buzz Grissinger and I at Chrysler there. From 35 until about 37, Don had made contact with. Well, I won't start that way. One day, Don came to Buzz, and he called us out in the hall. And he said, I got something to talk to you about. He said, why don't we have lunch together and talk about it? Okay. So three of us had lunch, and he said, um, said, there's a chance of getting in at Nash, a very good deal. They want somebody to head up their design department there. And it's going to be a very nice setup. Money's going to be good, and this is going to be a great opportunity. So he said, why don't the three of us shoot for that?
And he said, as a team.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he said, I happen to know of this is that's in the wind. And he said, why don't we three of us make up some good looking samples? And he said, I'll take them over to Nash and sell them on the idea, and then the three of us can go over there and we'll have a good thing going. And he said, we can head up the whole thing. And we felt that with him instigating it, he would be the top dog and we would be his assistants there. And they would build up a whole styling section. So it sounded pretty good.
Had Nash not had a complete styling section?
They had been doing a lot of their work had been done by consultants, outside people. They had maybe a little inside activity, I don't know, but you never heard about it.
Right.
So, we started to work right away, Buzz and I, and worked home on our kitchen table. Getting a portfolio together. Oh, and this not only included automobiles, but this also included the appliances, Kelvinator.
Of course.
We're
going to
do refrigerators, we're going to do stoves, we're going to have an industrial design section.
Yes.
Yeah, good deal. So we worked like hell. We did automobiles, we did stoves, we did refrigerators, and then we'd work separately, then we'd get together and compare what we had, and we'd go to Don Mortred's apartment and he'd see what he was doing, and then he'd come out to our house and our homes and see what we were doing, and we'd tie the whole thing all together.
Really? Were you married at that time?
Yes, I was married.
Mm-hmm.
And Don was, and so was. No, I wasn't married. Don was married, and Buzz was married. But this was in 37, that's right.
Yeah,
I remember. I was married in 38, this
okay.
year. So, anyway, we got this portfolio together, and it was very impressive. And we had did a bang-up job. We did full-color renderings and an illustration board, and we had flaps on our drawings. We made up a special case, a carrying case. It looked really first class. So day came and for the presentation, and Don said, I'll take these over, and I think we're in, you know.
You went up to Nashville the whole portfolio.
Yeah, so he took the day off, Chrysler, and went over to Nash and for this meeting with George Mason and his lieutenants. And we didn't hear anything from Don the rest of the day. And so we could hardly wait until the next day when they came to work. They went, you know, they came and said, well, what happened? You know, what's going on? Are we in or what? And so Don shook his head and says, Jesus, he says, boys, I made a pitch, but he said, we lost out. He said, George Walker got taken. So, that's tough, you know, but that's the way it goes. A guy's got a name and got the office down in the Fisher Building, and everybody knows him, and so I guess that's how he got it. And Walker really couldn't draw it out. He had to. Anyway, he got the account, and shortly after that, Don Mortred joined him.
You begin to smell a
So we smelled a big rat right away there. Don went over as George Walker's representative and heading up the Nash design, and not only automobiles, but culinary as well. So Don got the big job out of it. And Buzz and I got the little boy shot at. So
you got what?
we got with the little boy shot and nothing. And
did you ever confront Don with this? What is this, Don? You're getting us out of this.
He just said that Walker called him and offered him a job.
He took him at his word.
Yeah. And Walker didn't have anything to show. All the stuff, and that it was presented as Walker's portfolio. It was a deal between Don and Walker.
Exactly what happened. Later years, did Ortrud ever tell you exactly what happened?
He never did, but Walker. Well, years later at Foreland, twice he sort of brought it up. But as I say, he had nothing to show whatever to get that account, but we did all this thing for him, and he got a big fat retainer out of it, and Don got a big job over there and was head of design until the fellow from Ed Anderson. Uh-huh. Took over after Mortrud left. Mortrud started doing boat work on the outside, and he got the Chris Craft account, and then he left there and designed boats for the rest of his life, as far as I know.
You guys are still making $200 a week at Chrysler,
which wasn't not a week.
which wasn't bad, but you.
No, well, by that time we were making a little bit more. Okay. I was hired at 200, but by 1937.
Certainly had visions.
Must have been about 300. But we
whole package must have seemed enormously attractive.
Oh, it was. It was. We thought we were had a, you know, the inside track, because Don said he heard about this, and boy, if we would get these things together, we stood a good chance. Mm-hmm. And but that's how Walker got that account.
Well, just a postscript. What did Walker say years later to the?
Oh. He was he eventually got into Ford, and when I worked at Ford, I went with Ford in 1955, I guess it was, 4 or 5, and then I was there about a year, a little better than a year. And anyway, I got an offer from Chrysler, and it seemed more attractive to me than what I was doing at Ford. And Ford at the time really had the pressure on. I'm getting ahead of my story here.
Well, just as a quick postscript.
Anyway, exactly when I quit Ford, went to Chrysler, George Walker called me up at home that night and asked me what it was all about. He was still a consultant, but he still had the reins of the place there. I said, "Well," he said, "Why did you want to quit?" And I said, "Well, no reason, George." I said, "I just got a better offer from Chrysler, and I just felt that it was something I'd rather do." And he said, "Well," he said, "I'll if you stay," he said, "I'll arrange it so that you can head up the advanced design section here." And he said, "I'd like to see you stay." He says, "I feel I owe you something."
Uh-huh. You said, "Why?"
No, I didn't have the nerve to question him. But I knew from the way he was talking, and he was always nice to me whenever we would meet at Ford. Uh-huh. Boy, I was buddy, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I could have had a job with him at his design studio in the Fisher Building.
Yeah.
He called me up once after he had got the Nash account and wanted to know if I'd like to come down there and work for him.
You'd seen your material.
And I turned him down, and I said, "No, I was happy where I was." But he tried very hard at that time to get me to come to work for him in his industrial design office. And then his little remark about I feel I owe you something. Now why would he say that? Because we had no communication with Ford.
Still talk badly about Ukraine, you and Buzz out of the.
Yeah.
What Buzz say about it? Was he upset?
Well, at the time, neither one of us, we were disappointed.
Yeah.
But we thought it was perfectly legal.
But then Mortrud left, and you said, "Hey,
Yeah, well, then that's when we started to tie it all together.
You got this deal doing the work for George. And
We did George's portfolio for him. He got a big deal out of it, and that eventually led him into Ford Motor Company. He wouldn't have gotten into Ford Motor Company, I don't think, had he not had the Nash in back of him as automotive, because he had no automotive experience,
right,
whatever.
He wanted to break into the automotive.
That's right, and that's how he got it through Nash, and then he went to Ford from there.
Well, aside from Mortridge, you had a marvelous group here. Tell us a little bit about these gentlemen that you... as a matter of fact, I think we should stop here.
All right. How about a little...